Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Health.
The Slow Meat 2015 Symposium and Fair recently took place from June 4th through 6th, 2015. The event brought together producers, butchers, thought leaders, and eaters of every ethos to address the conundrum of industrial animal husbandry and to celebrate the alternatives. Heritage Radio Network was on the scene, set in Denver, Colorado, as Dr. Temple Grandin kicked off the event with opening remarks.
We just couldn't be more pleased to kick off this event this way. So everyone, please welcome Dr. Temple Grandin.
Well, it's really great to be here today, and I've got a lot of things to talk about. You know, one of the big questions that people often ask is, does cattle or other animals know they're going to get slaughtered? And that's something I had to answer really early in my career. So I'd go over to the local plant, which was a Swift plant in Arizona. It was a big plant. And then I'd go out and watch cattle being handled out at a feed yard at a ranch. And I found they behaved the same way at both places. And I sometimes would go back and forth in the same day just to look at things. And oftentimes they behaved better at the plant than they did at the feed yard because the plant actually had better handling. Now, what are some of the things that animals get afraid of, especially when they come to a new place, any new place, something novel, a coat on a fence, a hose on the ground, a reflection on water? You know, maybe at one day they've got the reflection on the water. Another day, they don't. You get rid of a lot of the little distractions that make animals balk, like a hose on the ground, then they're going to walk right up the chute. So I would get down in the chute to see what animals were seeing. You see, and the thing about a slaughter plant is you're taking them to a new place. Now, some of the animals that get the most scared when you take them to a new place are some of the ones where they've almost had too sheltered a life back at the farm. They may have been fed by one person with one vehicle. They've never learned to tolerate different types of vehicles, different people. And those are the animals, when you take them to town, will get really, really upset, especially if they have real high-strung genetics. Okay, there are genetic differences in animal temperament. And where an animal is really going to show its genetic temperament is when it's suddenly confronted with something new. Maybe an umbrella opening, you know, something like that. Something new. And there was some research done by a French researcher named Bourquet. And Bourquet found that the cattle that got upset when startled with something new at the farm were also the ones that had the highest stress levels at the slaughter plant. And people that show cattle and show horses, I always say, well, have you ever had that experience where he's fine at home and he's going nuts at the show? Well, there's a lot of things you got to get him used to that are at the show, things like flags and balloons, things with rapid movement. And I also did an article titled Assessment of Stress During Handling and Slaughter, and I looked at the stress hormone levels, at the cortisol levels, and they were about the same at the slaughterhouse and at the farm. They ranged from very low to really high and really, really bad. Now, when it comes to meat quality, one of the most important times is that last 5 minutes before slaughter. If your steer's bellowing and kicking in that last 5 minutes, or maybe he's been poked with electric prods, you're more likely to have tough meat. That's some research that was done by Robin Warner in, down in Australia. Pigs that get all agitated and jam in the chutes in that last 5 minutes are more likely to get pale, soft, watery meat. That's called PSE. For pale, soft, exudative meat. Now, a long-term stress, like maybe off feed for a long time, there was a big storm 24 hours before slaughter, that's more likely to cause dark cutting meat. This is meat that's darker and drier than normal, with a real high pH. That's a long-term stress, where short-term stress is shortly before slaughter, cause tough meat, pale, soft, watery pork. Now, one of the questions I had just out there before we started was some problems at small plants with USDA getting very, very strict on the Humane Slaughter Act. Well, big plants have had the same problem with it, like getting shut down for 3 days. Now, I believe in humane slaughter. I've been in this field for 40 years. And in the 80s and the early 90s, the big plants were horrible. You would go in there and they'd be broken equipment. Oh, and the little plants were even, they were horrible. In fact, what I found with little plants is they either were really good or they were really bad on the little plants. And I used to think I could fix everything with equipment. And I found it was fairly easy to get plants to buy new equipment. But getting them to operate it correctly, only about half of them even thought about operating it correctly. Then in 1996, I was hired by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to do a survey on humane slaughter practices. It was bad. I went to 22 plants, and only 30% could shoot 95% of the cattle on the first shot because their stunner was broken. And the normal way of rendering animals unconscious is a captive bolt stunner that with either an air, compressed air or a blank cartridge shoots a bolt into the head, instantly retracts. And when it's well maintained, it works really well. And the biggest problem was broken equipment. People simply did not take care of these captive bolt guns, whether they were the handheld cartridge fired or they were running off an air compressor. Then in 1999, I was hired by McDonald's and then Wendy's to implement their animal welfare program. And I used a scoring system that I actually originally developed for the USDA, where you measure five really simple things. How many cattle do you shoot on the first shot? And I found in my original data that about 20% or so were able to do the 30% were able to do the 95%. And so you, to pass the McDonald's audit, you had to shoot 95%, get them dead with one shot, everything dead when you hang it up on the rail. Only 1% could fall anywhere in the whole facility. See, it's an outcome measure. I'm not telling them how to build a plant. And only 3 cattle out of 100, that's 3%, could be mooing and bellowing and making a big fuss in the stunning area. And then as far as electric prods go, I had to get 75% in with no electric prods. And my baseline data in a lot of cases showed 500% of the cattle were getting zapped with electric prods. So they had to make 5 numbers, sort of like traffic rules. And of course the industry threw a gigantic fit. And then they knuckled down and did it because it was something reasonable. Most plants now, whether they're big or small, are running right around the 97 to 98% level. That's really good. Now we have a problem. You know, unfortunately, the Humane Slaughter Act is written where it says all. And some animal activist groups decided to force the USDA to enforce the all. Well, the problem is, in the practical world, all is not possible. You can be really good. Now, where you can have a zero tolerance is before you cut up any animal, before you start to skin it, you have to get it unconscious. But in the very, very best plants, running at 97%, you then immediately shoot it again, bang, it's dead. And that was getting misrepresented, where they were telling some of the people that were interested in welfare of animals that the guideline, which was used by the Meat Association, the American Meat Institute, was allowing plants to cut up live 5% of the cattle. That is complete, absolute, total nonsense. That's not true. Everything had to be dead, unconscious, and yes, they are going to kick. You might want to look at some videos I have online. Beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin, pork plant video tour with Temple Grandin, and turkey plant video tour. Shows how large commercial plants work. So you've got a lot of lawyers that work for activist groups that are suing USDA and going Freedom of Information Act on them and driving them crazy and forcing them to enforce the all. Well, that can be really bad for small plants. Big plants, yeah, there's been some bad stuff, like 2 days shut down. That's happened. Now, what's a sensible thing to do? You need to, I would say the minimum on cattle on captive bolt, stay at the 95% level or better. And then you better immediately, if you do miss, you shoot it again. So if you're using the cartridge fired stunner, you'd have the ammunition right there, and immediately within 10 or 15 seconds, you've shot it again. That's a sensible thing to do. You go in there and your equipment's broken, yes, you deserve to get busted by the USDA. Maybe you deserve to get a suspension, which means they shut the plant down for a while. But what's happened on this is all common sense is gone. And I was just talking with Mike Calcrate, and then he said, I need to bring this up. And he was worried that it was putting some of the small plants out of business. Well, the big plants aren't going to get put out of business, but it's making their life hard, too. Like employees that are doing those jobs are so nervous that they're going to fail. I've been in plants. I was in a plant a year and a half ago where an inspector stood there watching for him to miss and then would shut the plant down. And the poor guy that was doing the captive bolts about ready to have a nervous breakdown. I feel very strongly about humane treatment of animals because I can remember the bad old days. And I can remember the bad old days when there was no enforcement. Dragging downers around, drag them the whole length of the yard, broken guns where you're shooting them repeated times, beating animals up, all kinds of really bad things. The bad old days were bad. When I was working in construction on supervising equipment installations in the 80s, the early 90s, bad, bad, bad. And I've seen a whole lot of improvements. All right, now when I go to a plant, I actually find stunning's rather boring. Big plants right now, some of them are doing right around a 99%. And then immediately a second shot. That's as good as they're going to get. I did an audit this fall at two large plants. One shot a perfect 100, the other shot a 99. And then I was out doing a training class at another plant, and he was right around the 98, 99% level, and immediately doing a second shot. That's as good as they're going to get. It is the practical world. And one of my big concerns today is people getting, they're going into all kinds of policy things too far removed from the world of practical things. You've got students growing up today, they don't cook, sew, do woodworking, do theater, do all kinds of practical things, because practical things don't always work perfectly. I can make a slaughterhouse work really well, and then some of them are really, really working well, but I can't make them perfect. Now, where I tend to see a problem now is a problem with the animal coming into the plant. I'm getting very concerned these days about leg conformation. You go too much overemphasis on single traits, on things like marbling or some other trait, rapid growth. I'm seeing problems with twisted claw, post-legged. That's where they're too straight. Both pigs and cattle can have this, have difficulty walking. I'm concerned on some of the high-end natural cattle. I saw some really bad lice. Well, you can breed genetic resistance to help not have so many lice. And these are cattle where you can't use any artificial stuff on them. Well, that's a welfare problem. These poor things had rubbed their butts raw. I saw them in the last 6 months somewhere in the United States, real high-end, fancy Angus cattle going into a fancy program. And these poor cattle were twisting in half trying to lick it, going, twisting, trying to lick it, and they couldn't lick it because they were big and fat. That's a big welfare issue. So when I see a welfare issue now, something that really is a real issue, not something where you're getting certain activists trying to enforce the Humane Slaughter Act to the point where it's not even possible. Unfortunately, the law says all. So when the lawyer reads that, you've got some people that really like to get rid of the meat industry. They're vegans, and they'd like to get rid of the meat industry. And I feel very strongly that we got to treat animals, we raise the food right. The other thing that people don't realize, and I was looking at this book that's over there on beef and the land, is there's a lot of land in this country where the only way you could raise food on it is livestock. And when you do livestock right, it can improve the land. Now, you got people out there that want to just get everything off the land. Well, ranchers maintain water sources that livestock drink out of, like wildlife also drink out of. You get out in the field and you find out things are not so simple. And I'm worried that in our government we're getting to where you're getting people totally divorced from the practical world. So it all becomes ideology. And let's just end up and talk about how animals think. An animal doesn't have words. So the only way they can store their memories is pictures, sounds, smells, touch sensations. It's sensory-based, not word-based. It's also very, very specific. Well, there's some generalizations animals can make. Ladies are good, guys are bad. Sorry, guys. Guys are more likely to abuse animals. They'll make that distinction, and I think they can smell it, too. But for example, if you train a horse to tolerate a blue and white umbrella opening, that does not transfer to tarp or this tent blowing away. See, because when you think about it, it's a totally different picture. That's the thing, a completely different picture. I knew a horse that was terrified of black cowboy hats because he was abused by somebody wearing a black hat. White hats were fine. So to get you to think about sensory-based thinking, now imagine I have a slideshow up here, and I show you a picture of, like, cute kid, something like that. You kind of get a nice feeling from that. That's sensory-based. That's not word-based. And then the next slide, I put up the worst, scariest snake I can find on Google Images, and you go, ah! You see, that was sensory-based. That was not word-based. You know, something with the fangs coming at you like that. I'm planning to, like, revamp my behavior slideshow and do some things like that, because I want to try to get people to understand what sensory-based thinking is. You know, if you're handling animals, pigs, cattle, or other animals, and they get excited and scared, it takes half an hour to calm back down. Give your animal a chance to calm back down. Now, the tattered cover's supposed to be here. I think the guy got sick or something this morning, and they don't show up at 1:30 at the book signing. I brought a few books with me that I will have here. I'll go get them at lunchtime. I've got my humane handling book, a few copies, Animals in Translation, Animals Make Us Human, and a couple of copies of Thinking in Pictures. I'll bring those over. But it's like, I want you to try to think, how does the animal look at things? No, not how a person would look at it, but how does the animal look at things? I think what I want to do right now is I always like to do lots and lots of questions, so we can get more going with questions, and I'll repeat the questions. Okay, I'm going to pick somebody. Okay, right there. Okay. Okay. Well, I think there's the thing you were questioned about, environmental impacts of cattle. If you look at that book that's over there in the next book stall, some of the stuff that, you know, done with savory grazing systems, you know, cattle done right can improve rangeland. I went to a very interesting talk given by a soil scientist that I went to in January. This is something I did not know before. And he showed a map of the world showing the areas of best growing soils and worst soils. And the best growing soils in our corn belt came from land originally grazed by bison, you know, where they densely graze one area, then move on to the next area. You know, fertilize the ground, then move on. And then the second best land for grazing, putting crops on, was forested land. See, and you get the litter from the trees. And I think that's interesting that some of the best land originated from where herds of bison grazed. That's where we're growing corn right now. The other problem we've got in this country is we got huge amounts of land. You cannot grow crops on this land. And I have been in every part of the United States, out in the country, both in the summertime and the wintertime. And you take this rough country. I was just up in Montana. There's no way you're going to grow crops on that land. But you can grow various types of grazing animals. I mean, you've got cattle, sheep, deer, elk, bison, there's a whole bunch of them.
Dark cutters, long-term stress?
Yes, dark cutters is a long-term stress.
What causes it?
All right, let's talk about the physiology of dark cutters just a little bit. All right, dark cutting beef, and it's mainly in beef, not in pork, is beef that's darker and the meat's real sticky and dry. Now, if you vacuum package that meat, it's not going to last as long. It will go bad more quickly when it's vacuum packaged. Now, in the muscle, You have a substance called glycogen. Kind of imagine glycogen is the muscle's fuel. It's what, and when glycogen breaks down, lactic acid is secreted. Okay, and this happens in the last 5 minutes of slaughter, tends to make tough meat. But then there's a point where you use up all the fuel in the muscle. All the glycogen gets used up, sort of like a car running out of gas. And when the glycogen gets used up, then the pH rises and you get the dark, sticky meat. Now, dark cutting can be very variable, because if you have even an eighth of a tank left, you're not going to have a dark cutter. Now, there's various factors that will determine how much fuel you have in the tank. Cattle-fed grain tend to have higher glycogen stores than cattle that may had a lower energy ration. Okay, things like long transport times, that might run out the fuel. Things like a storm. This is a really bad one. A storm, 48 to 24 hours right before slaughter. Hot one day, winter the next day. Like I saw a thing on TV with a giant hailstorm, and they were scooping up the hail with loaders. Well, if that kind of event happens 48 to 24 hours before slaughter, you're probably going to end up having some dark cutters. Other factors are hormone implants. You know, you push the biology. Some of the rapidly growing breeds more a little more prone to it. But a variety of factors contribute to dark cutting meat. It's basically when it runs out of the muscle glycogen. Now, if you show animals at the fair, in animals that are raised by themselves, don't know how to get along with other cattle. And so when they're put together, they fight. And if you have animals fighting 3 or 4 days before slaughter, or fighting at the yard at a plant, that's another thing. Do that muscular exertion. Uses up the muscle glycogen, and you're more likely to get a dark cutter. But you kind of have to view it sort of like a car running out of gas. Everything's fine until you run out of gas. Moving cattle with no hot shots. Now, my opinion on hot shots is not to totally ban them. You want to get cattle to, most cattle you can move without electric prods. It should not be your primary driving tool in your hand. It should only be used if the animals refuse to go. Now, there's different reasons they can refuse to go. Be super tame, then you take the feed bucket, put a halter on them, and lead them in. You don't drive them. You lead those cattle and put them on the trailer. You get an animal, let's say, back at your farm that absolutely won't go in the squeeze chute. It's better to buzz it once than twist its tail. But if you really work carefully with your animals, you can drastically reduce the amount of electric prod use. Research right now by Ronaldo Cook up at Oregon University up at Oregon has found that if you acclimate heifers to handling, you have better conception rates on your artificial insemination. In other words, what you want to do is take your young heifers you're going to keep for breeding and just quietly walk them through the squeeze chute. Don't catch them. Don't do anything. Quietly walk them through, and then when they come out of that squeeze chute, their favorite treat is right there when they come out. And making that first experience with those corrals a really good first experience. Because the first experience with something new like a stock trailer or the corrals is a bad first experience. You know, like let's say bashing them on the head with a head gate accidentally, they are not going to want to go back in there again. So it's really, you know, another basic principle in handling is when an animal voluntarily cooperates with handling, you don't get all the fear stress. When you force animals to do things, then you get all the fear stress. So I'm a big believer in acclimating animals to handling. Now, if you're doing a savory type pasture rotation, it's very important that the mama cows don't run into the next pasture and leave the babies behind. It's very important when you move cattle, not let mama cows get separated from babies. If you're working in an extensive operation, you know, there'll be times where the mama cows will stash their babies with a babysitter, and then they go out and graze. You don't want to move cattle when calves are stashed with a babysitter. You want to make sure the calves are with the cows when you move them. And then when they go through a gate, controlled movement. They got to go with a controlled movement. Now, if you have tame cattle that you lead, one of the things that you want to do You don't want to just honk the horn and they come running and the babies are ditched. Much better thing to do would be take your vehicle, go out to where the cattle are. Then you honk the horn and then you lead them at controlled. Then when you get up to the gate, I don't want them mobbing and pushing. Well, you stand nice, then I open the gate. You mobbing and pushing, I don't open the gate. You want to, let's say you have an animal just blowing a great big fit in a squeeze chute. I'm not going to let it out when it's blowing a fit. It stops blowing a fit, then I let it out. But controlled movements and not letting mama cows get separated from calves is extremely important. And I discuss this in my book, Humane Livestock Handling. I also have a book called Improving Animal Welfare, A Practical Approach. Improving Animal Welfare, A Practical Approach. Those are available at Amazon. Maybe Tattered Covers bring them. I don't know what they're bringing for books. But if they don't show up, I will have a limited selection of books of 130 that I brought with me. Okay, back there.
Could you share your views on carbon dioxide stunning for pigs?
Carbon dioxide stunning for pigs. Okay. When you evaluate a stunning method, such as captive bolt, a gun, a regular gun, or electric stunning, those methods, when done correctly, instantly make your animal unconscious. Instantly. Now, you use any type of gas or any other kind of chamber type thing, unconsciousness is not instantaneous. So what you have to do is look at behavior before loss of posture. That's the ability to stand. When the animal faints and can no longer stand, it's going to be unconscious. Now you're going to get reflexive kicking. Okay, you shoot an animal with a captive bolt or you use electric stunning, you're going to get a lot of kicking. You can take the head off and you will get a lot of kicking because the circuit for walking, it's located right here. And you can take the head off and this circuit goes crazy, and that's why you get this kind of a movement. So I want to look at what does the pig or the chicken do before it loses the ability to stand. The other thing you've got to look at is your entire handling system, whether it's poultry or whether it's pigs. Now, with the pigs, one of the advantages you have is I can just run them up in little groups. They get on like a little freight elevator. So your handling is fantastic. With poultry, I've eliminated stressful hanging the bird on the line, which is very, very stressful. I now bring them in the travel container. There's various types of travel containers, single coops, drawers, dumping systems, and that whole travel container goes in the chamber, and I don't have to handle the animals at the plant. That's a huge advantage on handling. So I've got to look at it from a whole system perspective. So let's say the gas causes a little bit of gasping. Okay, maybe that's a good trade-off for getting really good handling. Now, where I personally draw the line is if that animal tries to escape the container. No, that's not acceptable. Now, in pigs, there are genetic differences in how pigs react to CO2. Some of the pigs, like the Yorkshire pig, have a very good reaction. There's some other pigs that have some of the Pietrains have the porcine stress gene. Some of those have a bad reaction. But the bottom line is looking at behavior before loss of posture. Now, some other basic principles is with pigs, you want to very quickly put them into 85 to 90% CO2. Chickens, you raise it very gradually. I got to see a video that a chicken company sent to me that showed a CO2 system where they raised the CO2 very gradually, and they put a video camera in there with them, and that worked really well. You put chickens in, adult chickens, full-sized market birds, into high concentrations of CO2, they will go crazy. That is not acceptable. Chicken, market-sized chicken, you have to raise the CO2 extremely gradually. Now, baby chicks, they die, seem to die almost instantly, high CO2, but the older chickens, they have a really bad time if they're put in too quickly. So you might put a video camera in there with them. But I kind of look at it like this. I got rid of really stressful, awful handling. So maybe they do a little bit of this or a little bit of that. That's a trade-off. But if they start trying to get out, that's where I draw the line. That's my personal opinion. I draw the line at that, and I've written that up in my book, Improving Animal Welfare, Practical Approach. I also have a website, Grandin.com. Just my last name, Grandin.com.
where I have a lot of information. The other, you know, I get asked all the time about ethics of eating meat. And I said, well, you know, these animals would never be born at all. They'd never be born. Now, some of the biggest welfare problems we got now is okay, you breed it for rapid growth, you got lameness issues. Yep, I have problems with that. The other big problem I'm concerned about with all foods, and that includes plants, if we breed for max production, loss of disease resistance. Look at the yellow banana. Right over there, there's some of those yellow bananas. There's a disease going through those right now. They're all clones. And they were clones, but they weren't biotech. They just used cuttings, plants. We just used cuttings to make clones. Okay, right there. Okay.
And he's been advocating for a long time. And what we do with all of our cattle is that when the cattle are going or at the slaughterhouse and as they're handled,
okay,
until the stunning point, there's a person physically present that is familiar.
Okay, well, let me just repeat what you're saying. What you're saying is that you were with Nyman Ranch, and when, you know, you started Nyman Ranch, and when Nyman Ranch knew you were running it, somebody the cattle knew was there with them.
And
yes, that will help reduce stress. Yeah, if the cattle have somebody with them that, like, walks them up the chute, they're going to get less stressed because then they're not alone. And the other thing you want to make sure that doesn't happen is, let's say you brought three cattle in or four cattle in and one single is going berserk by itself. That's another thing you don't want to have. Cattle don't like to get separated from other cattle that they know.
But can I just clarify?
Yes.
Well,
that's right.
That's
exactly what I said. The person that takes them there needs to be somebody who raised them so the cattle know them. And there's actually some research that's been done with shape. And the question that was asked in this research is, can a person that the sheep know reduce stress the same way a conspecific is? That's a scientific word for a flock mate. In other words, having a person that raised them there with them, the shepherd, when they are alone, or some of their fellow flock mates. And the person actually, in terms of reducing stress as measured in the blood, could replace some of the flock mates. I have another book that's real expensive. It's called Livestock Handling and Transport, 4th edition. You can buy it on Amazon. I'm not happy with the price of this book. I do not set the price. But in that book, I've got authors from around the world that have reviewed a lot of the scientific research. And someone who's really interested in that might be interested in getting Livestock Handling and Transport, 4th edition. I don't set the price. Don't bash me for the price. You know, textbook sets are they're kind of expensive. Okay, right here. And who do you press? Who do you press for? Now, well, you got a press badge, so what? Who are you writing for? Okay, the student newspaper at one of the colleges. Okay, fine. Okay. One of the things is I'm one of these people that genetically couldn't be a vegan if I wanted to be. I think there are genetic differences in the ability to tolerate a vegan diet. I'm not one of them. I would have to at least have dairy and eggs, fish.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Well, there were,
I can tell you, when it, the slaughter plants, the thing is that I found slaughter plants were easy to fix. The slaughter plant's the easy part to fix because out of the 75 McDonald's suppliers, only three plants had to do something expensive to get to where they could pass those guidelines. Things like non-slip floor in the stun box, repairs of equipment, changing lighting. It's amazing what I could do with lighting. Add a light, move a light, put a piece of cardboard up so they didn't see certain things, and it would fix it. You know, they were easy to fix. We get outside the slaughterhouse, things get a lot more complicated. Okay, right there. Oh, I know, egg gag laws, let me tell you. Egg gag laws, the dumbest thing egg's ever done. absolutely stupidest thing they've ever done. And now I have an email I got to answer. Somebody wrote to me and said that one of the states that want to make it against the law for a whistleblower to report animal abuse. That has some really serious repercussions. No, that's not how you fix problems. Now, the thing is, the slaughter plants are really doing a great job and nobody knows about it. Because I can remember the bad old days. And when we did beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin and pork plant and turkey plant video tour, we didn't go picking over the animals. Those videos were shot quickly. We walked in there, shot it, used the footage they shot. It was done quickly. And the turkey one, some people say the turkeys are afraid of people. There's a whole house full of toms, and they were showing off their tails. They wanted to mate with me. That's what they wanted to do. Okay, right there. Well, the big plants have not been resistant. Cargill's got it in theirs. JBS has got it in theirs. But there's been some people that have been very resistant, but there's others that have not been resistant. And those video cameras have made a big difference. When those video cameras were first put in, what we found was stunning did not change. That was so equipment dependent. You got to have a good gun that's been maintained. Electric prod use. That's the thing where the videos have really made a difference. Now, one of the problems we have out on farms is the amount of video equipment required. Also, who's going to watch all these videos? You see, you have a manageable number of plants. Okay, I'll take Cargill, for example. I don't know, you're talking about 9 or 10 plants. That's a manageable number. Hundreds of farms, how would you watch all those videos? That's part of the problem, and then just the cost of it. Well, yes, and I'll tell you something else we learned on those videos. 10% of the people had to be removed because they just wouldn't put the electric prods away. What I have found on stockmanship is if you go out and you train people, 20% will stay good. They are natural animal people. There's a whole bunch of others I have to constantly supervise, and then there's about 10% that I need to just remove. Another thing on any animal thing, and I don't care big or small, you cannot overwork and understaff. Because if you do that, you are not going to get a good work. And I've seen this happen on big operations and on small operations. You just simply cannot do that. Now, what I've been seeing now in animal rights videos on farms, the real atrocious abuses, there's getting to be less. When you start looking at recent video, the absolute worst stuff is dairy, unfortunately. It's dairy. Chicken, I've looked at some recent chicken videos. Yeah, that was a little rough handling. I looked at one just recently, and I was pretty much normal industry practice. But I can remember the bad old days in chicken. There's a famous video of guy throwing chickens against the wall like it was a job. And then, of course, there's the infamous Westland Hallmark, the waterboard cow, the forklift ramming a cow over. That's bad old days stuff. You see, and that's one of the things that made the USDA clamp down. But now what's happening is they've got activist groups, lawyers, buildings full of lawyers going after where they're going to enforce that all. In other words, okay, plant, big or small, you've got to be perfect. Well, in the real world, I can make them really super good, but I can't make them perfect. That's just impossible. Okay, right here. Well, unfortunately, I'm seeing some trending. The question was the future of confinement systems. Well, I just was in Spain recently and China. It's all inside. You don't see an animal outside. I had visited with some people from Italy, and I looked at about 100 pictures on laptop. It's all inside. They're on cattle or on concrete slats like pigs. There's some environmental forces that are going to intensify ag. I look at some of these abandoned buildings downtown and I think, okay, now we've got LED lights. Maybe that old round Holiday Inn that looks like the Starship Enterprise is going to get abandoned. And we'll grow not animals in that, but grow other things in it. But there's some forces for intensifying ag. There's some people now putting mama cows inside. I'm not that happy about that. You know, and there's forces out there that I can't control. As I said, the slaughterhouses are easy to fix. They're very easy to fix. And I can fix them with simple things. We get out in the outside slaughterhouse, all kinds of ag stuff. Things get a lot more complicated. Mobile slaughtering. The thing that's really good is you can buy a mobile unit that enables somebody coming in new to get into setting up a small slaughterhouse for a reasonable cost. Because to build a bricks and mortar plant from scratch costs a lot of money. Now, I think most of the mobile plants are going to be like the house trailer that you set on a slab and it stays there. Or it may be docking stations. Because I got to have electric hookup, plumbing hookup. I've got to have a way to deal with sewerage. And so I might spend a week at this sale barn, then spend a week somewhere else, move around to docking stations. You would be a simple corrals for, you know, unloading area, holding pens. That would be part of the docking station. But when you start looking at prices for building things, I can buy one of those mobile unit trailers for a fraction of what it, and even though if I park it somewhere. And then I can use used refrigerated vans that I can buy, semi-trailers. I can buy those. I can park them on a slab. That can be my cooler. And then I use smaller trucks where I don't have to have a semi-driver's license to haul meat in. I can pick those up used. Those are some ways that you could get into it, you know, for a sensible amount of money. You see, then another issue is getting inspection. You know, it's going to be USDA, it's going to be state. You know, one bad thing that could backfire on the USDA going totally crazy on humane slaughter is the plant's going to revert to state. And then you're going to have worse standards. Yeah, state is not equal to federal. Okay.
I have one more question for you. What do you think of HIMP, the hemp program that was a pilot in some of the pork plants?
The hemp program? The bottom line is you need to, basically, I look at, you know, that's a method of inspection. You know, looking at large plants, does an inspector actually have to physically look at every animal? Probably not. Because now we've got laboratory analyses and things like that you can do, make sure meat's clean. If you've got one advantage of raising pigs inside, they don't pick up things like trichinosis. That's started to have some resurgence. As I said, when I get outside the slaughter plant, things aren't quite so simple. The other thing we have to look at is a plant that slaughters young animals, which have a lot less pathology. And most plants doing the hemp program where they're cutting back on inspectors physically looking at animals, they're doing young pigs. They're not doing old sows. They're not doing the old mamas and the papas. They're doing young fed animals. A lot less pathology. Okay?
Can you talk a little bit about finding genetics without taint for hogs?
What do you mean, genetics without taint? I don't know what you mean by that.
To avoid castration.
Okay, to avoid castration. You might be able to get, some pigs that have less taint. Some people smell boar taint, some don't. I was in Germany last fall, very interesting trip, and all the pigs are boars there. And you used to think that the only pigs you could raise as boars and not have taint were very small boars that weigh less than 100 kilos or 220 pounds. Well, I got to see German pigs there, and I got to see Dutch pigs. And German pigs would just come in, lay down, act like normal pigs. Dutch pigs were crazy, fighting, humping. It was just completely crazy. So right there, there was a lot of difference in between Dutch pigs and German pigs. Another way to get rid of boar taint is to basically vaccinate pigs against the testosterone, so they don't make the testosterone. And they're not given a hormone. You see, the way the pituitary gland works, there's releasing factors that come out of the pituitary for all the different hormones that tell the body to make the hormones. And you vaccinate them to block the releasing factor from the pituitary that makes the testosterone come out. And that's very popular in Brazil.
Is that accepted by the animal welfare?
Well, from an animal welfare standpoint, it's just a shot. You got to vaccinate pigs anyway for other stuff. Well, then you better have really hardy genetics if you don't vaccinate. Then you got to have hardy genetics.
We have a closed herd. We don't vaccinate.
You don't vaccinate for anything? Well, what Improvest is, it's very popular in Brazil, but in Germany they're not using it. They're not using it in Germany. But the thing I noticed just going to the slaughter plant was the difference in behavior between German pigs and Dutch pigs.
What is
the,
why?
I don't know. You know, you select animals for different traits. I don't think they deliberately selected those pigs to fight when they got to the plant, which is going to have a bad effect on meat quality, and to be trying to hump each other and be thinking about sex at the plant. And German pigs don't think about sex when they get to the plant. Now, one of the problems that you have with breeding is if I'm a farmer in Holland, I only see my own pigs. So I don't realize that behavior is even, kind of abnormal. You see, and what that is, it's a Yorkshire type of pig, an early puberty type of pig. German pigs are probably a later puberty. And if I only see Dutch pigs, I don't know if the behavior's getting bad, they fight a lot, because I don't see any other pigs. But I went to one plant that did German pigs, I went to another plant that did Dutch pigs, I instantly saw that difference. You see, another problem we had in the 80s in pork, with just the regular commercial pork, was they bred for rapid gain, huge loins, and thin back fat. And they ended up with a tail biter that fought a whole lot and was real excitable. Now, would anybody deliberately select pigs for fighting? No, of course not. But the problem is when you overselect for single traits, traits are linked. And I also have a book on genetics and the behavior of domestic animals, another pricey textbook. Genetics and the Behavior of Domestic Animals. You can pick it up online. But one of the problems we had with these breeders, because I can remember when those pigs first came in, if you only see those pigs, you don't realize how bad those pigs are because you have nothing to compare them to. The reason why I noticed it, I was going to the plants, and I'd go to plants that bought pigs from every different producer around there. And you'd walk through the corrals, and there'd be one pen with a lot of tail biting and fighting, and another pen that just laid there calmly. It became obvious. But a lot of those people breeding those pigs that had those bad traits, they never saw any other pigs. This is what I call bad becoming normal. And it happens, and you do not realize it. Right now, we've got some bad becoming normal in certain lines of beef cattle that are being bred for certain traits, and they're getting leg problems, similar to some of the leg problems I've seen in pigs. That's bad becoming normal. We can't let that happen.
What kind of meat do you eat?
Well, I travel, so I have to eat what's available at the airport. Okay? Okay, what about you right there? I'm traveling all the time.
So, you love animals, and you are an expert in animal behavior, but you also have defended the industry very strongly at many times.
When you say I defended the industry, what do you mean by defending the industry? Let's be a little more specific. I certainly don't defend a whole lot of, bad behavior in that industry. Well, okay, now the problem in that video of the Whole Foods chicken farm. Okay, you can go into any large farm, or you can go into a small farm, and you're occasionally going to have an animal that's gotten in really bad shape. They never showed on that video the other good chickens that were in there. It's a chicken farm, and they deliberately did not show what did all the other chickens look like. They didn't. The video I saw did not have wide shots. The video that I saw, there were no wide shots on that Whole Foods chicken video.
Okay. Well,
they didn't. What I was able to look at had no wide shots. So all they had was a bunch of close-ups of this chicken was injured or this chicken was in bad shape. Now, where I'm going to really get after somebody for neglect is you have what I call petrified chickens, where it's very obvious people didn't go out and pick up the deads. But okay, I don't care whether you got 200 chickens or you got zillions of them. you're going to have a few chickens that get bad. And you have to look at, well, how many bad chickens? Is there evidence of neglect? And the videos I saw did not have wide shots in them.
What's your position on going back to heritage breeds, especially for pork?
Well, one of the advantages of some of the heritage breeds is tenderness. And I had kind of a little wake-up call about bad becoming normal on pork tenderness. You know, you used to be able to cut pork with a fork. And pork got to be, we used to call it the official hog of the National Hockey League. And where I really felt that way about it, I went to a Nyman Ranch banquet in Des Moines, Iowa. And this hotel really tried to wreck this meat. Heat lamps and everything else, let it all dry out. And I could cut this Nyman Ranch with a fork. And this was about 15 years ago, where most of the pigs were sort of the more heritage type of pigs. Very, very tender, even after the hotel tried to destroy it. And it had a very fine muscle fiber. And I could cut it with a fork. That's genetics. You see, you get the slower growing animal. See, when they bred for a larger loin, okay, there's two ways you can make a pig or any animal have a bigger loin. Add more fibers or make the fibers that are there larger. You know how the ends of the asparagus, tough? Well, those big fibers are tougher. Because most of the time, it's just the fibers getting bigger. And I didn't realize how tough some of our pork had gotten until I ate that Nyman Ranch. This was a good 10 years or so, 10 or 15 years ago, ate that Nyman Ranch. And some of the big commercial companies realized they need to put a little fat back in, maybe slow the growth down a bit. We also need to be looking at disease resistance in pigs. But that was bad becoming normal with me because it wasn't until I ate that Nyman Ranch, and now some of the stuff's not quite as good now. They're getting more of the commercial type genetics, but that was genetics. That had nothing to do with being outside. It was fiber diameter. Okay, flavor of animals. A lot of it is what you feed it. There's a big effect on flavor. Like if you let dairy cows get in the onions, the milk's going to taste just terrible. So what you feed it has a huge effect. But there's also effects on things like tenderness. It's interesting in China, they don't like the white meat. China, a lot of white chicken meat, they hate it. They like the dark meat. Okay, I think I'm going to take maybe just about three more questions and then we'll end it. Okay? If I can't survive on a vegan diet because I get so lightheaded, I can't function. And I've tried it. Believe you me, I've tried it. And also a lot of the nuts that you have to use, almonds, they're big water pigs. Look up how much water almonds take. They're gigantic water pigs.
You were talking about the pork and the PSE in the 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, on the PSE, if the pig gets all excited, squealing and jamming in the chute in the last 5 minutes, your pH gets lower. It's a low pH. You're burning up a lot of glycogen, low pH. That last 5 minutes, that's how that wrecks the pig. Squealing and fussing, he's burning up glycogen, and that lowers the pH. And then when you get dark cutting meat, you run out of glycogen, and the pH rises because there's no glycogen to burn up and turn into lactic acid. Okay, right back there with the vest. I don't really know. I'd have to get a lot more detail on it. What are the rules? Tell me exactly what it will do down at the plant level. I don't understand theory. Okay, I know on the pork thing, it has to do with not having an inspector physically inspect every pig. That's probably not necessary. Well, I tend to go with outcomes, and one of the things we need to have a really strong thing on is measuring bacteria. Laboratory tests. You see, my method for evaluating humane slaughter is put numbers on it. If you don't make that 95%, you're going to be kicked off the McDonald's approved supplier list. Boy, back in 1999, I saw more change than I'd seen in my whole entire career. Food safety, it's outcomes on lab tests. That's the thing that's really important. Salmonella, you can get, listeria and all those kind of things like that. It's the outcomes. And I didn't tell a plant what kind of floor to put in their stun box, but they don't, you know, they don't make their numbers. Now, the other thing on lab tests is it's impossible to be perfect again. Meat's not sterile. Nothing in food is sterile. But you got to get the bad stuff down to a real low level. It's the practical world. It's not going to be perfect. We can make it really good, but we can't make it perfect. And I think I'll end on that. I hope Tattered Cover's here. And if they're not, I'll go get some of my books. And thank you all for coming.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.